Regional Treasure for the Asia/Pacific Area, 1976. On Friday, December 19, 1975, one of my major mentors in Citibank, Don Howard, called me to his office and asked me to assume the role of Regional Treasurer for the Asia/Pacific Area. At that time, Don was kind of the treasurer for the entire organization, including Citibank's business in the USA and its parent company, the one-bank holding company, Citicorp. Here is the birthday letter of Don Howard, former Chief Financial Officer of Citibank.
I am delighted to put on paper some of my thoughts about Hines. He has several unique gifts. It is unusual for a person to have one truly unique gift, and he has at least two. He is one of the most effective teachers I have ever known. I spent 4 years at the Harvard Business School, two as a student and two on the junior faculty, so I observed some of the best. He has a gift for evaluating the future potential of individual traders. He has the ability to develop effective reporting processes, and he is a wonderful human being. He is a class act. In the early 1960s in Frankfurt, Hines hired three young men traders, Ernst Brucher, Eddie Giger, and Fritz Menzel, to work in the Citibank trading room. Individually and collectively, these men became among the most successful traders in the world. They founded the core of Citi's worldwide dominance in foreign exchange trading, which still exists. Hines can rightfully take credit for creating one of the pillars of Citi's profitability for over four decades. Hines loved to teach young, aspiring traders, and he did a superb job. He taught the basics and strategies, and most importantly, appropriate ethical behavior. They learned from Hines, then went to junior positions in major trading rooms, and then established their own careers, all thanks to Hines. Hines had the gift of spotting high potential among the trainees, and he looked after their careers at Citibank like a parent might. The individuals benefited, and so did the bank, big time. Hines developed the reporting formats which enabled senior management to be comfortable in delegating large responsibilities to the local traders. This enabled the traders to take on more responsibility, to grow, to act more quickly, provide better service, and capitalize on market opportunities. As a result of his remarkable teaching abilities, Hines has a network of contacts throughout the business and academic worlds that is quite astounding. He has earned and maintained the respect of heads of central banks, professors, bankers galore, and literally thousands of former students, including one that he had the good sense to marry. It has been my pleasure to know, work with, and be a colleague of Hines Rill. Congratulations, Hines, on reaching this milestone and being able to look back over your career and life with the satisfaction of knowing that you have done extraordinary things. Don Howard.
Don asked me to think about this over the holidays and give him my decision at the beginning of the new year. Just as I knew immediately in my gut in 1970 that I would accept the proposal to move from Germany to New York, I also knew immediately in this case that I would agree to move from New York to Asia. Wife Ingrid agreed, and so we prepared to move with 8-year-old Ralph and 6-year-old Janine to the Far East. The question was, where to? Citibank did not have any regional office in Asia. Therefore, the bank allowed me to pick the city and country where I wanted to live. Initially, I thought that it had to be either in Singapore or Hong Kong. However, once I took a realistic look at Manila, Philippines, it was clear that at that time, 1976, this was the most attractive place, and we had to move there. Here were all the reasons. Ferdinand Marcos was president. He was a dictator, but everything worked well and the crime rate was low. fantastic housing was available at low cost. I was now international staff because my home base was the USA. With my housing allowance, I could afford a brand new palace-type house in Das Marinas Village, one of the top living areas for rich locals and expatriates like myself. The cost of everything was low. Ingrid hired 6 servants, including a driver and his wife who served as a cook. The monthly cost for all 6 of them was $200 a month. The private schools for Ralph and Janine were outstanding, with Jesuit-type discipline and academic standards. I was not part of the local Citibank Manila branch staff. I was in my own regional office. President Marcos wanted to establish Manila as an international financial center and rolled out the red carpet for people with regional responsibilities like myself. There was a 10 o'clock curfew for locals, including Americans working in our local branch, but not for me. I was regional staff, and if I wanted to, I could stay out all night. There was a punitive import tax on all luxury goods, including fancy automobiles. Again, not for me. I was regional and imported a wonderful Mercedes that in Manila would have cost, including the import tax, 4 times what I paid for it in the USA or Germany. The local airline, Philippine Airways, was voted best in Asia and offered non-stop flights to all regional capitals where I had to go at least every other month. In short, it was paradise, and moving there instead of Hong Kong or Singapore was a no-brainer. Life in Manila, Philippines, 1976 to 1978. Just before we arrived in Manila, the city had hosted the combined biannual meeting of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and World Bank. In preparation for this major event, dictator Marcos had built many luxury hotels with gourmet restaurants. After those international meetings, there was an oversupply in hotels and restaurants, which further suppressed prices at those facilities. Hotels advertised that they had a ratio of 6 employees for every single hotel guest staying at their hotel. The dress code was commensurate with the tropical climate, with temperatures in the 80s and 90s year-round. The formal dress which I wore every day to the office was called a barong. This was a thin embroidered shirt which was considered the national dress of the Philippines. It is lightweight, usually made of banana leaf, and worn untucked over an undershirt. There is no tie worn with it, but the cuffs are elegant, and I usually wore cufflinks with it. The specific color, material, and cut change slightly with the fashion of the quarter. One of the top tailors in Manila had standing instructions to make 3 new shirts for me whenever there was a change in style. The shirts were inexpensive and cost something like $20 apiece. We joined the top local country club, the Polo Club, which, as the name suggests, also was a major polo center. I used the club mostly for tennis. Janine improved her swimming with almost daily swimming lessons. My son Heinz from Germany visited 2 times, in 1976 and 1977, for several weeks, and always had an exceptionally good time.
The Philippines are considered world headquarters for ghosts. Even though our house was brand new and we were the first tenants, our house staff insisted we had ghosts. They believed that the construction workers had not left food for the ghosts when they went home in the evening, and therefore, the ghosts were now making trouble. Even Ingrid confirmed that she could hear steps coming her way in the middle of the day, and that she could talk to those ghosts. Janine experienced ghosts in her room, and there once was a fire in her room, possibly created by those ghosts. I had several tennis rackets, and they were sometimes mixed up by ghosts, because all of the servants promised not to have touched them. The staff insisted that we should bring a priest to the house and have it blessed. I hired a priest, who walked through the entire house, burning candle in hand, with all staff and our family following him. He blessed each room of the house, and after that, there were no more ghosts. My business activities also were successful, so that, in summary, life was good for the family and for me. Business activity as regional treasurer in Manila. The local treasurer, Ray David, gave me one of his best people as my assistant. It was a slight Chinese lady named Linda Quatico. She was very smart and learned whatever she did not yet know about treasury in a very short time. She was the perfect assistant and held all the administrative stuff away from me. The treasury business worked very well in all countries. We were making good money and were constantly ahead of ambitious budgets. Creation of the Bourse Game in 1977. At the time, Citibank had a problem in all of its overseas branches, which was that the majority of loans were made in US dollars. This was not good. Any American bank could make dollar loans, even though they did not have the unique global branch networks that Citibank had. As a result, there was a lot of competition in making dollar loans, compressing the profit margins on those loans. Loans in the respective local currencies of countries around the world had much larger profit margins because there was less competition. Citibank had branches in all those countries and could have made very profitable local currency loans. Instead, we were making dollar loans out of those foreign branches. The reason for that was that our branches did not have enough local currency deposits to make local currency loans. We needed to change two things. Find a way to create more local currency deposits so that we could make more local currency loans with big profit margins instead of dollar loans with small profit margins. Increase our foreign exchange trading with customers. This was profitable all by itself and would help create local currency deposits. Foreign exchange profits were non-funds revenues, NFR, which do not create assets on the balance sheet and were much more desirable than net revenues from funds, NRFF, which do create assets on the balance sheet and require more equity in the balance sheet. The problem was that our traders in the treasury departments understood all the above, including the business of foreign exchange, but our traders did not have contacts with customers. Our account officers and relationship managers, that is, our corporate bankers, had that contact with customers. We had to teach those corporate bankers the foreign exchange business so that they were comfortable talking about FX and were able to solicit that business from our customers.
A foreign exchange and money market trading simulation. Successful and copied by other banks. Used globally to this day. The answer was to create a foreign exchange and money market training activity from which our corporate bankers could learn the foreign exchange business. I did exactly that in Manila and called it the Bourse Game. Bourse is the French word for exchange, so it was the exchange game. My goal was to develop such a game and turn it into an institutionally recognized treasury training facility. I did that, and it was a success. The game was always held for 32 participants. At least half came from other countries, in a hotel, so that we had at least 16 hotel rooms in a natural way. We created 16 banks of two people each, and each bank used a hotel room as their dealing room.
I gave lectures in the morning, and in the afternoon, there was trading between those 16 banks on the phone, so that participants could apply in practice what they had learned in Zori in the morning. The phone calls and talking on the phone was important, so that participants would learn and become familiar and comfortable with the professional terminology of FX traders. That was what they needed to solicit FX business from our customers. The Bourse game was a tremendous success. Linda Quatico was a great help. I think I could not have done it without her administrative support. 1 year later, in 1978, Citibank Brazil invited Linda and me to hold the Bourse game in Rio de Janeiro, where it also was successful. The goal for the game to become an institutionally recognized treasury training facility was achieved. Other banks copied it to train their own staff and their customers. The game is in active use globally to this very day. Professor at Asian Institute of Management, AIM, in Manila, 1977. As mentioned above, President Marcos had the goal to make Manila an international financial center in Asia. At the time when I had to decide where in Asia I wanted to live, Manila was called Pearl of the Orient, which already was true in many ways. And the reason why I moved there and not to Hong Kong or Singapore. The Asian Institute of Management, AIM, had lofty goals of becoming a leading regional academic institution. They had a self-imposed limit that no more than 50% of their students could be from the Philippines, which is to say, at least half had to come from other Asian countries. The president of AIM had been a priest. Therefore, he was called Father Jim. Father Jim was entrepreneurial and creative. Therefore, in late 1976, he wrote a letter to Dan Jacobson, the head of Citibank Manila, with the following request. When senior Citibank people from New York or other parts of the world come to visit Manila, would it be possible for them to spend an hour or so at AIM speaking to their MBA class to tell them about what is happening in the world? This would further bolster the international cachet of the school and also further support the reputation of Citibank for spreading financial expertise in the country. Philippine country head Dan Jacobson remembered that I had just established my own little regional office and had a reputation for giving seminars and that sort of zing. So he passed the letter from the AIM president on to me. I called the father, made a date, went to the school, and talked to the MBAs about the international financial markets, as well as the outlook for FX rates and interest rates. It was a success. Father called me the next day, asking for me to come back and do it again. I asked, "What do you want me to talk about?" He said, "Whatever you want. The students liked your style and would like to hear more from you." One zing led to another, and within a couple of weeks, I created an outline for a formal MBA course called International Treasury Management, for which students would get 3 credits. Many Asians, particularly the Chinese, have difficulties pronouncing my family name. Add to this that many Asians state the family name first, so that my name would be Real Hines. As a result, to this day, I am in most Asian countries called Professor Hines. Father Jim was industrious and also organized executive programs, which were often held in a small town called Baguio. This was a mountain resort about 2 hours away from Manila by car. I taught a half-day module in one of Zoe's executive programs, and in that context, met another American, Tom Johnston, a senior officer of Chemical Bank in New York. Tom also taught a module in that same executive program. He and I got along well and had a good time together. After 2 years as regional treasurer living in Manila, all 14 countries for which I was responsible were running well. However, there were consistently new ideas being born, which had to be pushed through and approved in New York. And New York would only approve if they understood all the new stuff. Explaining was difficult from halfway around the globe. So I decided that I had to move back to New York to be closer to senior management. That move occurred around the fall of 1978. I retained the same job and the same responsibilities, but would live in the USA and travel to Asia frequently. Even when I lived in Manila and traveled, I could only be in one of the 14 countries at a time. Therefore, living in the USA and traveling did not make that much difference from a job viewpoint and how often I would be physically in a given country. Father Jim at AIM regretted my departure because my Treasury Risk Management course had become very popular, and the question was, who would teach it in the future? The answer was as follows. The new head of all international business in Citibank came from New York to Manila and formally presented to AIM my 9 hours of video describing Treasury. One of my AIM professor friends received special indoctrination from me, and he, assisted by the video, continued to teach my course. The presentation of the video to AIM by a Citibank senior was covered by the local press, highlighting again the commitment of Citibank to the Philippines, import of know-how, and all of that. Moving to Hong Kong, in spring of 1980, Citibank decided to establish a formal regional office for Asia under the leadership of Ray Cathy, a Citibank old-timer and old Asian hand. He picked Hong Kong for his new regional office, and all his staff and direct reports had to move to Hong Kong. So I had to move back to Asia from New York, and I became a resident of Hong Kong. I did not move my family back to Hong Kong. They stayed in Darien, where Ingrid, with my approval, but without me ever having seen it, had bought another house. The family moved somewhere around 1979 from Hollow Tree Ridge Road to a beautiful dead-end street named Stephanie Lane. Hong Kong real estate prices and corresponding rentals had skyrocketed. With my housing allowance, I could afford to permanently rent a suite in the Hong Kong Hilton with a bedroom, living room, kitchen, and dining room. All of this was cheaper than renting an apartment in town. I personalized my suite at the Hilton with some of my own carpets, paintings, and other art objects flown to Hong Kong from New York, so that it felt as if it was actually my apartment. Also, I never had to worry about getting a taxi. There was always one available at the entrance of the Hilton. Obviously, I traveled a lot, both around Asia and back to the USA, to see my family and the people at Citibank New York. Stories about Japan. Once during the period between 1976 to 1980, when I was regional treasurer for Asia living in Manila, I took a trip to Tokyo to review our treasury operations there. My plane landed in the afternoon, and I went straight to our Tokyo office with my baggage in hand, that is, before checking into my hotel, usually the Palace Hotel. Our treasurer, Noda-san, took me to dinner straight from the office. We had a bit to drink, and it got late. Noda-san suggested that I come home with him, meet his family, spend the night at his house, and then go straight to the office with him the following day.
Anybody who knows anything about Japan will also know that going to a Japanese private home, and even more, staying overnight, is most unusual. His wife and two teenage daughters were very surprised and literally did not know what to do or say. They spoke very little English, and everything had to be translated by Noda-san. When I write this down, it sounds like nothing special, but believe me, it was a most unusual, almost unbelievable experience. Another story playing at the same time, 1976 to 1980, reflects the unusual way of Japanese zinking. In those days, I would go to Tokyo frequently, about every 6 weeks. Noda-san liked scotch, and there was still a high import tax on scotch, almost double the price for local Japanese. Because of that, and because it is a Japanese custom to bring presents, I always bought a bottle of scotch duty-free on the plane for my friend. One day, an American lady who had worked for years for the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo explained to me that I should bring 2 bottles for my friend if I really wanted to please him. I said, "Of course, anybody would prefer to receive 2 bottles instead of just 1 bottle." But the lady explained, "It is not the volume of scotch. Instead, it is the number of bottles. If you give 1 bottle to a Japanese person, he will feel uncomfortable because he has your bottle and you do not have it anymore. However, if you give him 2 bottles, then you are indicating that you have many bottles, and giving away 2 bottles does not bother you much. Therefore, your friend will not feel bad." My last story occurred in the early 1990s, when I was invited to Tokyo to give my presentation on treasury risk management to Japanese banks. Jill was with me. I had made it known that I had heard a lot about the Tokyo fish market, Tsukiji, and that Jill and I would love to see it. So, of course, it was arranged. One of my American friends from another bank and his Japanese secretary picked us up at 3 a.m. at our hotel. Jill did not like getting up that early, but she wanted to see the fish market. The market is a huge hall that covers an area approximately 10 times the size of the grounds for any of the recent Olympic stadium complexes. Every night, some 50,000 people come here to work. Every kind of fish from the oceans of the world can be found here, from an inexpensive flounder to a 500-pound tuna. I never saw so many full sides of tuna in my life. What I call a side is a thick piece of tuna about 4 to 5 feet long. They come in a variety of qualities, and I was told that the same size of tuna in a higher quality can be 10 times the price of a lower quality. The first fish arrives at the market shortly after midnight. The auctions begin at 3 a.m., and the sales begin at 5 a.m., first to wholesalers and later to retailers. The sellers and buyers were yelling and bargaining, almost like trading foreign exchange at the Paris Bourse, at the Corbeil. The buyers in this market were obviously not housewives, but representatives of the top Japanese restaurants. The blades of the knives used to cut the fish are either stiff or flexible as needed for different parts of the big tunas. All knives are unique and specially made to order, with each knife bearing the signature of the owner and coat of arms of the craftsman who made it. The price of such a knife can be several $1,000s. Some knives are sword-like Takeda knives as used by the samurai. Others are much shorter and look like an Indian bichwa dagger. Every day, Zo's knives are sharpened and polished for a couple of hours and are as sharp as a razor blade. They cut through the heavy fish like bread knives through butter.
After watching for some 20 minutes, we went to one of the many little restaurants around the trading action, but still in that huge hall. We ate delicious fish, mostly raw, with plenty of sake wine. It was unbelievably good. I am not sure which was better, the high quality of the fish or the ambiance and the sake. Anyway, by 6 a.m. we were in bed again in our hotel, semi-drunk, and slept until lunchtime.